What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whiteley, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we're taking a look at the big stories from the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, all eyes are on the UN climate talks, but there's a big question mark whether Australia will get hosting rights to next year's event. In Tonga, voters are gearing up for Election Day, and Fijians search for the truth behind the country's coup history. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We start in Vanuatu, where a provincial council has come under fire over a new bylaw prohibiting menstruating women from operating and selling food at markets and roadside stalls. The new regulation, which covers Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, and surrounding areas, has been heavily criticized, with Prime Minister Jotham Napat calling it ridiculous and an embarrassment. Dr. Willie Tokon is head of the Association of NGOs, and he's shocked by the new rules preventing women who have their period from serving food.
I'm shocked to see this article because, firstly, I did not hear of any consultation. I don't know if they got any advice from the health people who provide health certificates for fruit preparers in our markets. I'm very shocked to see that. We are now getting, we're now penalizing our women. I didn't see any mention of restaurants and Chinese takeaways. I mean, how does an enforcement officer know that this woman is not supposed to be preparing food today? Do they go out every morning and ask every woman that are they having their periods or not? What are we coming to? I think that's absurd. It's discrimination against our women, especially our mothers who are struggling to put food on the table and also pay for school fees in these hard times. So, you know, if the province is worried about hygiene in food places, they should install water tanks so that these mothers can wash their hands before they touch any food. When they come in, they come and wash their hands. That's the way to go. We're supposed to be promoting our people. Now we're trying to put down our women.
What is your response to comments that were made that it is traditionally, if women are on their period, they are not supposed to touch food?
Like I said earlier on, yes, we've heard of traditionally, women on some islands, if not just touch wood, but if they were having their period, especially young girls. This is mostly young girls. If they're having their period, they would go and live in a house a little bit away from everybody else. If it used to be done before, now there's no basis for it. There's no reason why. Because now we have hygiene. We understand hygiene. And our young ladies, as soon as they start having their periods when they are 10, 11, or 12, they know how to look after themselves. And these are their rights. You know, we're actually infringing on their rights to do business just because they're having a period, which is something they have no control over. So please, I'm calling on SEVA Provincial Health, Provincial Government. Withdraw it immediately. And if you're worried about hygiene, put water tanks at marketplaces so these ladies can wash their hands.
The world's attention is on the Brazilian city of Belém, where world leaders are gathering for the COP30 UN climate talks. Delegates there have already decided that Addis Ababa in Ethiopia will host the 2027 leg of the talks. But the big question remains on whether Turkey or Australia will host next year's meeting. A decision is expected within coming days. But in the meantime, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape is calling for world leaders to bring the UN talks to the Pacific. Vanuatu's Climate Minister, Ralph Riginvanu, says he'll repeat that same message when he arrives in Belem early next week.
The Pacific has been pushing, has been putting all our weight behind the bid, the joint bid by Australia and the Pacific. This will have to be decided by the end of next week. Yes, I don't know what's going to happen. We're seeing Turkey's not making any moves to step down. But really, I mean, it's now up to the Western European and Others group, which is the group that Europe and Australia is in, who are supposed to choose the next host. It's really an internal matter for them now. In these last days, they've got to sit down together, particularly Australia and Turkey, and make some compromise, or I don't know how they're going to solve it. But really, it's in their camp to do it. We are simply outside watching them. We've made all our overtures. The Pacific Island leaders have repeatedly, at the highest level, said that we support Australia to get the bid. Unfortunately, at the General Assembly earlier this year in September, we were not allowed to come into the room in terms of meeting Turkey. So we've said what we've said, but now it's really up to Australia and Turkey and the other Western European countries to find some way to agree on one single host by the end of next week.
Well, given both Australia's leader and Turkey's leader aren't attending the summit, do you think we can read anything into that, given that maybe both leaders don't know if they're going to be successful for the bid or not, and therefore maybe don't want to be there to save face?
I don't want to comment on that.
Fair enough. And just finally, what would you like to see Australia focus on, you know, if it does host COP31, particularly in terms of representing Pacific voices and priorities?
We keep saying this. Australia needs to get off the fossil fuel pipeline it's on. Australia, there was a study just released before COP. Australia is one of the four countries in the world who have ramped up fossil fuel production the most since, you know, in the last years since Paris. So Australia is one of the big high emitters. And this is particularly in terms of the fossil fuel exports that are growing. Australia's just increased the life of, you know, Western Australia, the gas line there. They're continuing to expand fossil fuel production, and that is something that Australia can't do as a global citizen. And that was clear from the ICJ advisory opinion. They have a legal obligation to get off, to stop, to reduce emissions. It's not just domestic anymore. It's now all emissions, including exports. And this is the big difference the advisory opinion has made. You can't just count your domestic emissions, as we've been doing in the past, and saying, yes, we're on the net zero path. You've actually got to count everything you put out. And for Australia, the elephant in the room, obviously, is all the fossil fuel exports that are ramping up. That's a clear ask we've asked of Australia many times, and it needs to tackle that.
Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change, Ralph Riginvanu, speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. Australia and New Zealand's willingness to pay top dollar for recreation drugs is turning the Pacific into drug mules for cartels. A new government report outlines how gang members, many of whom are deportees, are transporting shipments of methamphetamines and cocaine through the islands. The details have been revealed in New Zealand's Ministerial Advisory Group on Transnational, Serious and Organised Crime's most recent report. The group's chair, Stephen Simon, says the quantities of drugs getting into Australia and New Zealand are incomparable to anything seen before.
For New Zealand, for example, the amount of methamphetamine our customs service stopped at our border over the entire of 2014 is the same amount they currently stop every week in the last year. And so what we're talking about is a scale which is far beyond anything anyone had ever anticipated. And what we're seeing now is we could almost reliably count on the drugs that were coming into New Zealand were coming through Asia, often transiting through Australia, whereas now we'll just open up this gateway through the Americas, up through North America, down through the Pacific and into New Zealand and Australia. So we're talking about a scale which we couldn't have conceived of before.
We'll get to those gateways, particularly through the Pacific, in just a second. But before we get to that, why is it so much more? Is it due to an increased demand within Australia and New Zealand for drugs?
We certainly have a healthy percentage of our populations who are willing to consume recreational drugs, but also it's the price that we are willing to pay. We're probably up there in terms of the price we pay for drugs like methamphetamine and cocaine. So we're paying record-leading prices for it, which means it's driving the demand.
Now, deportees have been at the centre of a lot of the trafficking within the Pacific Islands. We've reported in the last 12 months about how criminal gangs like the Comancheros have even opened up chapters in places like Tonga. But I want to ask you, how do they actually go about facilitating the shipments of these drugs? Like, do they serve as middlemen? Are they distributors within the islands? Or are they there to basically sort of move the shipments on?
Bit of everything. What we're seeing is that some of those drugs seem to be stopping and being either used as payment for those who are assisting them in the Pacific. And so what you're seeing is in the Pacific, it's sprung up their own drug problems, if you will.
I see. And what's hindering authorities from getting on top of this?
Coordination is a big one. We have police and customs liaisons in the countries. But what you find when you're on the ground there is what's lacking is a cohesion, a pulling together and having a plan. What is the strategy between Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands? What are we doing collectively to say, how do we target this problem that's emerged and how do we stop it from getting worse?
Well, it's probably not clear on whose jurisdiction it is either. Like, at what point does it stop being a South American problem and start being a Pacific or Australian or New Zealand problem?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good observation, and it's one that I certainly found when I was there. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and not clear who's making what meal. And we've seen that through challenges that presents building trust within the Pacific with the authorities, so that we can work collectively together. But I guess with the approach that we took when we were preparing these reports was to say, look, you know, we kind of need to cut through all of that, because at the end of the day, what these drugs are doing to Australia and to New Zealand is horrific.
And just finally, you kind of did answer my last question in some ways, but are there any particular countries that are most in danger of really falling victim to this narco state sort of epidemic? I mean, Fiji would be one, but are there any others?
Fiji is the most likely, just because of its size, because of the nature of the ports. I mean, it is a coupling of some 350 islands. And so if you're looking to bring drugs across in either a submarine or a small vessel or a large vessel, sending a small vessel off to land, there's just so many opportunities. There's a lot of haystacks there for you to place your needle. And you've got a relatively impoverished workforce. So these customs officers, these police officers, earning something around, say, 40,000 Fijian dollars a year. And if you have something like organized crime offer you the same amount of money you'd earn in a year to turn a blind eye to something. One of the things I heard when I was on the ground in Suva was the local New Zealand police officers being told by some Fijian officers that there was offers of bribes to just not go somewhere. Not facilitate something, not opening a door, not like taking a bag off a carousel. Just don't be in a location at a particular time, and they could generate the same amount of income as they'd earn in a year.
And that was Steve Simon, chair of New Zealand's Ministerial Advisory Group on Transnational Serious and Organised Crime. In a little under a week's time, Tongans will go to the polls for the national elections. 26 seats will be up for grabs. Out of these, 17 will be for the people's representatives voted for by ordinary Tongans, while 9 seats are reserved for nobles. The ABC's Marian Kupu took to the streets to find out what Tongan voters want in their representatives.
I will vote for the person who has love for the poor. Like myself, I'm not well off, and I'd like someone who helps the poor.
I trust the current government. With the past governments, the way I see it, like our local representative, I don't think he's reliable. These politicians, they just worry about themselves.
The kind of leader we hope for is someone who works for everyone, not just his own constituency.
As a woman, do you believe your voice is being represented in parliament?
I don't believe so. For example, the hope of owning land, especially as a woman, no one in Parliament has raised this. I guess because in Tongan custom, the heir is the eldest son. But even if the eldest is a woman, and after her comes a son, he will still become heir. No one has really discussed land ownership for women.
My ideal parliamentarian would be a person that, first of all, has a plan, and also to deliver with transparency and accountability and be responsible to its voters. Eh? We've seen a lot that come in, taking the seat, no plan, think as they go, and so they end up with nothing. Eh?
I'm looking forward to see a government that they prioritize first education, health, and security. They need to look at the statistics. Whatever policy and priorities will be based on evidence-based, yeah, and this is statistics.
It's very important that they're community-minded and that they don't pick sides, but I believe they should be able to unite people and work well with everyone.
Do you think your voice as youth is represented in Parliament?
I don't think so, Marianne.
And that was some of the voices of voters ahead of next week's election, and that report from Marianne Kupu in Tonga Tapu. You're listening to Pacific Review on ABC Radio Australia, bringing you the top stories from across the Pacific over the past week. When Tongans head to the polls, only citizens who are in the country on election day can take part in voting. This means thousands of citizens working overseas in Australia and New Zealand will miss out on casting their votes. The ABC's Finau Fonua takes a look at the dilemma facing many Tongans based overseas.
Social media is a key strategy in any election. In this Facebook video, a candidate donates food to school children, to which they respond by screaming out his name. In another video, a candidate gets motivational and promotes himself with inspirational music. Tonga's Coconut Wireless is full of election videos, where the public engage in political debates on the comment sections. There's a lot of passion among those who intend to vote, and also among those who wish they could vote.
We should get a chance to vote from overseas.
Lioa Tupo is among thousands of Tongan seasonal workers in Australia who have no say in Tonga's political future. They're not allowed to vote because Tonga's election rules require them to be in the country.
They should have a way how to do it. I mean, like, we have to fill up a form and send it to the High Commission here in Canberra or whatever. I don't know. Because you know how we came in a visa. We should be home, like, but we will not make it until the election will already happen before we get home.
You're listening to PMN Tonga with John Poole.
PMN Tonga is a New Zealand-based Tongan language radio talkback show. It targets the over 80,000-strong Tongan diaspora in New Zealand. They discuss sport, community, and politics. Tonga's economy is hopelessly dependent on the income of the diaspora, foreign remittances being the main source of income for most households in Tonga.
Yeah, I think diasporas should be able to vote.
New Zealand-born and raised Eti Tapuwelawelu is among thousands of second-generation Tongan New Zealanders who support the economy of Tonga with remittances. He regularly travels to Tonga. In fact, most foreign tourists and investors to Tonga are members of the Tongan diaspora.
You know, we're still connected to Tonga. So many of us still read about the Tongan news and what's happening over in Tonga. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be good to have a say, but then I can see the point why people would say you shouldn't, because you don't live there. It doesn't impact you as much as the people that live there.
However, local Tongans like Davita Kava are skeptical about overseas voting. Kava says overseas voters are far removed from the challenges that locals face on the ground.
That's the bit that I'm concerned about, because they're not actually living in the country. People are looking from overseas and they're judging of what's happening in Tonga of what they see from social media. And there's a concern that the large number of Tongans overseas could outweigh the votes of those living in Tonga, shifting like the power dynamic.
To my beloved parents, thank you for leaving the tropical islands to pursue education as a pathway for me and my siblings to survive.
New Zealand-born and raised Edmund Fehoko exemplifies what many Tongan migrants dream of, their children reaping the benefits of New Zealand's education system. He works as a senior lecturer in nutrition at the University of Otago. Despite the pride he holds in his Tongan identity, Dr. Fehoko believes overseas voting needs to be limited.
I personally don't believe that Tongans who are born in diaspora, like myself, should have the right to vote in Tonga.
With Tonga's diaspora outnumbering the population of Tonga, Dr. Fehoko says allowing Tongan non-citizens to vote from overseas would be problematic.
If Tonga is to all of a sudden open up voting opportunities for Tongans overseas, there's going to be a heavy influence of not just Western education and understanding of doing things, but also not understanding what's actually happening in the ground. Like, I acknowledge that our remittances is massive, and that's just the heart of being Tongan, loto I Tonga, to support our Tongans back home. But to have voting rights, that's one thing I don't agree with.
Dr. Edmund Fehoko, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Human Nutrition at the University of Otago in New Zealand, ending that report from Finau Funua. For nearly four decades, Fiji's political past has been shaped by coups and silence. Now, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is aiming to break that silence by listening to the experiences of all Fijians. Before coup leaders take the mic, everyday Fijians will share their stories, as the ABC's reporter in Fiji, Letha Mavono, explains.
Fiji's new Truth and Reconciliation Commission has started public hearings into the country's past political upheavals, from the coups of 1987, 2000 and 2006. Commissioners say the process is about truth-telling, healing and nation-building, not reopening old wounds. Sekove Nangiolevu is a former chief magistrate, and he's been selected as one of the commissioners.
Our mandate is to consider the impact it had on the survivors, people who survived those the upheavals at that time. So that's one of the very important things. It's part of our mandate and the law that that created us in the first place. So that's the important part of our work, is to look at the survivors, and the truth-telling is a really important part of our work. My understanding, and our commissioner's understanding, is that by truth-telling, they'll bring out what had happened to them, and maybe it will help in the healing process. Come before us, we're happy to hear your story, and you're safe. This is a safe space, and you're protected under the Act, under the law. You are protected. So you know, fear that nothing will happen to you after you've given your story. So that's important. I think the psycho social that we provide for them, we provide counseling once they've given their story.
Commissioner Nangiolevu says the public hearings have already been deeply emotional, with whole families coming forward to share their stories for the first time.
They were actually in tears, and the whole civic, the whole room was filled with people with tears. Even the press said couldn't help it. I even had a tear in my eyes as I heard the stories and the upheaval and the impact it had on the family. What we want to do is bring social cohesion, forgiveness, and we move forward from here. That's what we are here to do, and we hope that is going to be the result of our work and the final report that we will give to the president.
As the commission moves from Suva to the west and eventually to the north, it will gather statements, hold expert hearings and community forums, all feeding into a final report due to the president in 2027. Gender specialist and community worker Anna Langer-Tambua is another one of the commissioners. She says the year ahead will be a critical one for the commission.
We're going to be doing a lot more hearings. The kind of hearings that we're looking at doing are expert hearings, which is hearings with sector experts. Part of our mandate is to look at the sectoral impact of the political upheaval on different sectors.
Langer-Tambua says the commission's work is also about accountability and inclusion, and that everyone, including leaders, are free to tell their truth.
Prime Minister Sitiveni Rumbuka has spoken to the media publicly about the fact that he's willing to come before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So we're following that, you know, and we're interested. Yeah, we have to provide opportunity.
Fiji Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner Anna Langere-Tambua ending that report from Lithe Mavono in Suva. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.